An artificial intelligence system of the type we've already developed doesn't think. Humans are conscious beings. And if you're going to create a super intelligent being that can do anything humans can do in all areas, then you have to discover a way of making a conscious being. And that's the barrier, for the very simple reason that no one has the faintest idea of what consciousness is,
right,
alone being able to construct it.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hey there, and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. I'm Shane Rosenthal. Joining me for this broadcast is a guest we've recently had on the program. John Lennox is Professor Emeritus of Mathematics at Oxford University and Senior Fellow at the Trinity Forum. He's the author of numerous books, including Can Science Explain Everything?, God and Stephen Hawking, and Where is God in a Coronavirus World? On today's program, we'll be talking to him about his latest book, 2084, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity. John Lennox, thanks for being back with us on the White Horse Inn.
It's my pleasure to be with you today.
So the last time we had you on, we discussed the global coronavirus pandemic, and this time we're going to talk to you about another global threat, namely the challenges presented by artificial intelligence and the future of humanity. Obviously, your new book, 2084, is alluding to George Orwell's famous novel, 1984, which is likely the world's most famous dystopia. So based on your title alone, it sounds like you might have a few reservations about the future.
Oh, certainly I do. But it's not all doom and gloom. I simply use that title. And by the way, it was suggested to me by an atheist colleague on a journey to debate with him, Professor Peter Atkins, who's a very famous atheist at Oxford University. And he asked me what I was doing, and I told him, and he said, I've got a wonderful title for you, 2084. So that's where the title came from. And the point is that there's enough dystopian thinking out there to justify the title.
Yeah.
But of course, I wanted to discuss the pros and cons of AI itself, narrow AI, the stuff that actually works at the moment, in order to help people come to a sensible appreciation of it, rather than either being scared to death of it or greeting it with open arms as if there was nothing wrong.
Right. You write that as he looks at the potential harm that it can unleash upon the world, even Elon Musk fears that AI is summoning the demon. And you also say that Stephen Hawking expressed his fears about the consequences of creating something that can match or even surpass humans. A super intelligent AI, he noted, will be extremely good at accomplishing its goals. And if those goals aren't aligned with ours, we're in trouble.
Yes. And it's interesting to note that this kind of thing is not only being said by sci-fi fiction writers, although it is, of course, and has been the subject of many dystopias and films in the past.
Right.
It's being said by serious scientists and entrepreneurs, and Stephen Hawking was a very bright person. He was concerned with what might happen, as is, incidentally, the present Astronomer Royal in the United Kingdom, Lord Rees. And similarly, he fears that the future will be very different in terms of what kind of creatures exist. And he realizes that there's a problem. And that problem is an ethical problem. In other words, it boils down to this in terms of present technology. What kind of ethical norms are we building in to the machines that we are designing?
Right.
And it's unlikely in my view, but suppose a superintelligence is created in some form. No, the ethical problem starts right now, because AI that's out there in our culture has got huge issues. You only need to think of artificial intelligence controlled weaponry to start with, or even AI controlled vehicles.
Yeah.
How do you program them
right
in such a way as to be ethically fair? in the difficult choices their sensors may have, whether to hit an old lady crossing the road or a line of children queuing for a bus.
And that's not just something that we're waiting to be determined in 2084. That's something that's happening right now.
Oh, it is indeed. Yes, it is indeed.
Now, in your opening chapter, you engage quite a bit with Dan Brown's recent novel, Origin. What did you find significant about the story he tells in that book?
Well, the book was brought to my attention by someone else. I'm not particularly a Dan Brown fan, although, like many people, I enjoy a good cliff-edging novel. But what was very interesting about Dan Brown was his stated motive within that novel. The hero of the novel itself is an expert in artificial intelligence called Edmund Kirsch. And this expert is determined to demonstrate that religions are false and use science to do it. And it would appear that that's partially Dan Brown's own motive to explore this kind of situation. And the way in which it's done interested me greatly, and it was to use AI to solve the two great problems of human existence. Where do we come from and where are we going? And since AI is able in the novel to solve this problem, therefore it eliminates God. But the book takes on a certain fascination because the hero of the book and of most of Dan Brown's books, Robert Langdon, he in the book mentions that DNA is a code, and a code to him indicates that there is intelligence behind it. So it's most interesting to see that the book itself raises the question of an intelligent designer. And I find that very interesting. And I deliberately used the book because of the millions of people who read it.
Right. In the novel, Dan Brown interacts with what's called the Miller-Urey experiment.
Yes.
Which was done in the 1950s, which purports to tell the origin of life by way of natural phenomena of chemistry and physics. What are your thoughts about the Miller-Urey experiment? And do you think it actually solved the problem of the origin of life?
Well, no one thinks it solved the problem anymore, really. The Miller-Urey experiment consisted in simulating a primitive Earth atmosphere and then passing electrical discharges through that mixture. And they discovered some of the building blocks of life, the amino acids. And it was hailed as the solution to the problem of life. But of course, what was not realized in the early 1950s was what Crick and Watson later were to discover, that the problem isn't so much getting the amino acids, it's getting them in the right order.
Right.
And the order is a linguistic code-like order. And the thing has essentially got stuck, in the opinion of many researchers on the origin of life, has got stuck back in the 50s because no way has been found. That is, no naturalistic process has been discovered that delivers semantic information of the type that's encoded in DNA. So that it was a hint that something could be obtained. And Dan Brown was quite clever because he actually researched into what had happened to the original material that Miller and Urey had used, and it was still in a lab somewhere. And subsequent research by Professor Jeremy England showed that after a number of years languishing in the lab, when they reanalyzed the sample, they discovered even more amino acids in it. And so Dan Brown starts with this and says, right, let's extrapolate that into the future. And that's when the sci-fi begins. And it's very interesting because Dan Brown was taken to task publicly by the scientist who did that work.
Interesting.
Who happens to be a Jew who believes in God.
And the Hebrew Bible.
He disapproved of the use that Dan Brown had made of his research. It's all very fascinating, but it leaves us that very little progress has been made in developing any kind of naturalistic scenario for the origin of life, although many very bright people have worked on it. And their work is interesting because they've discovered a lot more about life as they do the work. Just recently, there has been the offer of the Evolution 2.0 prize of $10 million for anyone who can come up with a naturalistic scenario of a self-replicating machine, something like that. It's been put up by Perry Marshall, who actually is a Christian. And that all makes it very fascinating.
Yeah. You write that the information stored in our DNA is, quote, now one of the most fundamental concepts of science. Although it's not physical, the information printed on a page is carried on the physical medium of paper and ink, but the information itself is not physical, a fact that would appear to create an insuperable difficulty for a strictly materialistic understanding of the universe. So is basically what you're saying that because information is non-physical, it simply can't be explained by things like physics and chemistry?
Yes, I think that's right. And I think it's a very powerful argument that has been largely ignored. I have tested many people with this who claim that they're reductionists in the ontological sense. That is, everything can be reduced to physics and chemistry. And I often just at the dinner table, and I've done it several times, hold up the menu and say, look at these marks on paper. And the person I'm talking to may say, yes, it says roast chicken. And I say, how do you know? Well, I've learned English, and that's what it says. The marks on the paper carry a meaning, roast chicken. So I said, okay, you're a reductionist. Please explain to me how those marks carry the meaning roast chicken, and all you're allowed to use is the physics and chemistry of the paper and ink.
Yeah.
And I've had several people sit back and say, but it can't be done. You've got to postulate a mind in order to do that. And I say, exactly. And that's why I believe that whatever physical processes are involved in, say, the production of DNA, there must be a mind involved as well. And if you step back from it, it's extremely interesting because materialism is one of the dominant philosophies of our day. That's all the stuff that there is, matter or its equivalent energy.
Right.
But it's not. We live in an information age, and physicists have recognized that information is a fundamental quantity in its own right that cannot be reduced to physics and chemistry. And to my mind, that's the end of materialism.
Yeah.
So there won't be any process out there to be discovered simply because you're talking about two completely different categories, that of matter, material, and that of information, which is immaterial. And the great irony of it, to my mind, is now here in the 21st century, science depends crucially on the immaterial and is rapidly showing this to be essential, not some peripheral notion. And of course, that supports the biblical claim, in the beginning was the Word. The universe is a product of a non-material God who is real, of course, nevertheless real.
And who is rich in information content, and he speaks the universe into existence.
Absolutely. He produces the kind of information that we can't produce.
Yeah.
If I say, let there be light, nothing happens. If God says, let there be light, there is light.
As you were discussing these kinds of questions with noted atheist Richard Dawkins at a debate over a decade ago now, he asked you the question, you know, if the universe is the creation of a God who speaks it into existence, who then created God? How did you respond to him when he asked that?
Well, that is such a silly question. I was amazed to get it from someone like Dawkins with his kind of education, because if you ask who created God, you're assuming God was created. But the central claim of the great monotheistic religions, and in particular Christianity, is that God is eternal. He wasn't created. So the question doesn't apply to any God that's worthy of the name God. And the sting in the tail is this. of course, his question is valid for created things.
Right.
You can always ask of a created thing who created it. So I said to him, you believe that the universe created you. So tell me, who created your creator? And as you say, it's over a decade ago and I still haven't had an answer. It is a very silly question indeed. And I just think it needs to be treated as it deserves.
Why is this question in your mind about human origins significant for the question about artificial intelligence and the future of humanity?
Because we are at the stage now in terms of science, particularly genetics, where we can begin to envisage a serious modification of the nature of human beings themselves. For instance, by modifying the genome in some way and therefore transmitting something that we have added or subtracted or modified to all future generations. In other words, we become human conditioners. And C.S. Lewis pointed out in the 1940s that what we would be producing is not humans, but artifacts, so that the final triumph of humanity would be the abolition of man. And that's why I regard it as very serious. We've never been in a position before to muck about with human nature. And if you come from a strongly materialistic, atheistic viewpoint, you will tend to say, well, what are human beings? They're simply advanced animals, and they've come to be by a natural, unguided process that has brought us so far. But it has brought us to the stage where we are now intelligent enough to take that process into our own hands. And why shouldn't we? If it can be done, it should be done. There are no theological or even moral principles that necessarily will hold anybody back from doing that. And that's where the problem arises and where I say in my book very clearly, we need to get back to the question of human beings 1.0 and what they actually are, because it makes a huge difference.
Right.
If you believe they're just a random product of a mindless process, or you believe that they were created in the image of an intelligent personal God, that makes a huge difference. And it also makes a difference to the reticence you should show about modifying them. And I think since everybody is interested in human identity, then we need to say something about this, because the rate at which it's going is scaring even some of the leaders in the scientific field who have no faith in God whatsoever, but they're worried about what could be done to human beings.
Yeah. You talk in your book about narrow artificial intelligence and how that's quite a bit different from what we know as general human intelligence. Can you go into that?
Yes. Well, narrow AI is the AI that already works. And if we've got a smartphone, which many of us have, we are involved with it virtually every day. Simple example, I buy a book on Amazon. A few days later, a little pop-up will say people that bought that book usually are interested in buying this book. And that results from the fact that it's harvesting information about me and putting it into a major database. And the AI system that actually sifts through that database and predicts what book I should buy next out of the millions of books available, it is a narrow AI system. Now, what is that? It is a computer-based system. A computer working on a large database, that is the information they've got about me and about all the available books. And the system performs one task very rapidly and efficiently that would normally require a human intelligence to do. And that is really a descriptor of most, if not all, of the AI systems that already are working around the world. And some of it is very beneficial. The example of the beneficial side, many of them are in medicine, and almost every day you read of a new AI system. A simple example is in x-rays, radiology. They take a million x-rays. That's the database. But you have to inform the database. So those x-rays are all labeled with the diseases that they represent. They're put in the database, and then I have difficulty breathing, and I have an x-ray. It's put into the system, and the computer rapidly compares it with those million, and out it comes with a diagnosis. And very often that diagnosis will be better, significantly better, than what I would have got from my local doctor. And this is obviously going to enhance medical diagnosis and subsequent treatment. So that's a very positive thing. But go back to my example of the book and what is happening commercially. The data that is being harvested, is the word they use now, about me, doesn't only include the books I buy, it includes the GPS positioning of my smartphone, and it may even include eavesdropping on conversations, marking where I've been, and all those kind of things. But what many people don't realize is that information that's harvested is being sold on to third parties without our permission.
Right.
And that's an intrusion on privacy, and it's very concerning. And Susanna Zuboff of MIT has written a book called Surveillance Capitalism, which is grabbing attention at the highest economic levels in our world, because she's warning that this is a very serious problem. And surveillance in general, not only surveillance capitalism, but facial recognition in AI can catch criminals, but can also be used to control a population or a subpopulation. And that raises all kinds of ethical questions and intrusions of privacy.
How is that different from what you describe as artificial general intelligence?
Well, the difference is that the narrow AI only does one thing. It's predicting what book you will read. It's accessing an X-ray library, one thing, and doing it well. The idea of AGI is to develop a machine that will surpass human beings in all areas simultaneously. In other words, you produce a superintelligence. And there are really two avenues of thought on that. First of all, we start with human intelligence and we enhance it by implanting chips, by adding machinery so that humans virtually become cyborgs.
Is this the transhumanism movement?
Well, the transhumanist movement has the simple idea of going beyond human.
Right.
And so that could either occur in the way I've just described by enhancing a human that you start with, or it could be, and here's where the sci-fi increases, it could be finding a way to make existence, mental existence, and all our experiences uploadable onto a silicon base so that we no longer be dependent on a carbon-based system and therefore be more endurable. And you probably know there are people who have died that are frozen in the hope that one day they'll be thawed out when we find a way to upload their contents of their brains onto silicon. So those two things, that's the transhumanist dream, is using these technologies to move beyond the human to a super intelligence.
After reading your book, I kind of sense that you're skeptical about those possibilities.
I'm very skeptical about the possibilities, but I'm not the only one who's skeptical. And a great deal of my skepticism has to do with the fact that the greatest barrier in the face of all of this is the word artificial. In artificial intelligence. And as an elderly now pioneer in this field called Dr. Joseph Mellichamp, who happens to be a Christian believer, he wrote a paper a long time ago in computing terms, 1985, I think it was. And its title is beautiful. The artificial in artificial intelligence is real. In other words, what we're doing in these systems is we're disconnecting intelligence in the sense that the machines are doing something that normally needs human intelligence to do. We're disconnecting that capacity from consciousness. Humans are conscious beings. And if you're going to create a super intelligent being that can do anything humans can do in all areas, then you have to discover a way of making a conscious being. And that's the barrier, for the very simple reason that no one has the faintest idea of what consciousness is,
right,
alone being able to construct it. So it seems to me that the hype begins precisely where folks think that they're going to make a thinking machine. An artificial intelligence system of the type we've already developed doesn't think. The intelligence, and this is the trouble, we use anthropomorphisms to describe these machines.
Right.
Artificial intelligence is almost an oxymoron because the artificial gives the game away. It is not conscious, but it's doing something that normally requires intelligence. And it takes a bit of time before people get their minds around that, because once people use the terminology, oh, we've got an artificial intelligence that does this, they immediately think it's but a short step before it'll do everything else, not right, realizing the barrier of consciousness between.
Yeah, you quote mathematician Hannah Fry as saying, for the time being, worrying about evil AI is a bit like worrying about overcrowding on Mars. Maybe one day we'll get to the point where computer intelligence surpasses human intelligence, but we're nowhere near it yet. Frankly, we're still a long way from creating hedgehog intelligence. So far, no one's even managed to get past Worm.
Oh, well, she's a good mathematician. she's got it right. And I think it's good to recognize that. We need to take a bit of the hype out of this, but at the same time, to recognize the good that's being done by systems that exist. And I say that as a Christian. I think this is a branch of science that Christians should be involved in. Involved in not only because the science is interesting and exciting to do as a career, but because this very field raises the huge ethical and moral problems, and they're going to increase.
Right.
And we need people to work in these fields in order to think through the issues and have something to say intelligently and from experience to people that are concerned about them.
Yeah, especially when it comes to the ethical dimensions involved in how you program these automatic driving vehicles and what the ethical implications are for how they operate in the real world.
That's right. And it's good to see that some people are thinking about it, but the problem always gets back to the who said so issue. What authority, what ethics is going to be built in? And the more sophisticated mm-hmm. things get, think of autonomous weapons, which can kill a target without you even lifting a finger, so to speak.
Right.
That has fearsome implications if such a system gets into the hands of a tyrannical dictator in a totalitarian regime.
Or even a country like ours. The more you cede power to this automation, the question then becomes who automated it. So you are relinquishing your freedom to the select individuals who programmed how it should operate.
That's right. And that's the tension that many people are already facing in our world. How much freedom are you prepared to give up to have security? Are you prepared to have CCTV televisions in every street in order to be safe from criminal activity? And there's a fine balance between well-motivated surveillance techniques and control, not to say anything about the problem that these recognition techniques at the moment make mistakes, or the AI systems have built-in bias. And that, of course, is a very serious situation indeed.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there's a lack of proper integration of an agreed moral code into these systems that doesn't lead to the anomalies.
You interact quite a bit throughout your book with the writings of an Israeli author by the name of Yuval Harari. Tell us a little bit about him and his book, Homo Deus.
Well, Harari is a historian, actually. He's written two books, Sapiens, on the origin of human beings, and then Homo Deus, about the future of human beings. He's really giving his take on Dan Brown's two questions, where do we come from and where are we going? And the title of Homo Deus is indicative of something that goes back to the dawn of history, to the temptation in Genesis 3, and the proposal that was put by God's enemy to the first humans: eat that forbidden fruit and you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. So God was misrepresented to them through a half-truth by telling them that God wanted to suppress them and keep them down, didn't want them to rise to his level and become as gods. But as with many people today, they don't see that the text is referring not to a tree of knowledge, but to a tree of knowledge and good and evil, which is very different. God wasn't against them getting knowledge. It was the knowledge that they didn't want to have that they gained.
Right.
But that has led right through history to the search for some kind of elixir of life, it's called, that will enhance humanity and cause us to rise. And therefore, Harari is building on this kind of thing, but building on it in connection with the developments in artificial intelligence. And he has got two principal agenda items for the 21st century. One, he regards death as a purely physical problem that will be solved by technical means, so that although human beings can die, they won't have to die. That's number one. Number two is then the accentuation and increase in human experience of flourishing and happiness. And that will be brought about by genetic engineering, by drugs, by artificial intelligence, and all this kind of thing. And so this fits into exactly the kind of scenario that Dan Brown's talking about. Like Brown, Harari is a strong atheist and therefore has no God dimension in order to reflect on this. And I include him in the book for a very simple reason. Exactly like including Brown, their influence is on millions of people, particularly young people, who will imbibe this. And someone needs to say something from a perspective that actually has got a great deal more to offer than Harari has. And that's where my book moves towards its end, because he says we're going to solve death as a technical problem, physical death, that is, and we're going to become superhuman. We're going to become gods. And my reaction to that is, it's ironic, but you're too late. The problem of physical death was solved long ago when God raised Jesus from the dead. And anybody who trusts him can receive eternal life and therefore is guaranteed resurrection from the dead. That is an uploading, so to speak, if I might use that terminology, that has got real credibility because the evidence for the resurrection of Christ is very strong. And secondly, we're told that we shall one day be in a realm where there's no pain, there's no dying, and the person that trusts Christ is given what's called eternal life. So the answer to both questions has already been shown in the Christian faith. And the supreme irony of the whole thing, when I look at it, is this: the quest for superintelligence, the quest to be Homo Deus, is humans striving to make gods of themselves, humans reaching upwards towards God. The central theme of Christianity is the exact opposite of that. It's God reaching down to human beings. Indeed, it's God becoming a human. And that for me is immensely important. And what I wish to do with the book, 2084, is to show that the Christian scenario has got the deep answers to the longings that are determining these other superintelligence transhumanistic scenarios.
You write at one point in your later chapters that post-human scenarios tend to be utopian almost by definition. And as we know, utopian thinking has usually led in the past not to a promised paradise on Earth, but to indescribable violence, war, and the deaths of millions. I'm wondering, you know, you've mentioned the relevance of the book of Genesis. Do you think that the quest for things like uploading consciousness to some kind of silicone-based system so that we're no longer constrained to the limitations of the body, at its root, is an attempt to eat from the tree of life in a way that hasn't been authorized?
Well, I think so. And it's very interesting. If you watch Jordan Peterson's talks on Genesis, he sees the importance of these things, even though he's coming at it from a very different perspective in terms of understanding how life came about through natural process and evolution and so on. But he sees the big idea, the notion of the danger of reaching up to God. And he talks about the central statement of Genesis 1, human beings made in the image of God. And he almost breaks off at his lecture and says, man, you neglect that at your peril. That's one of the central things. And the interesting thing is, you see, that the tree that they ate off, according to Genesis, was not the tree of life. It was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Mm-hmm. And then God stopped them getting to the tree of life.
Right.
And the very fact that they were forbidden to go there, I think, is the driver behind all this search to find, as I put it earlier, an elixir of life, some solution to the problem of physical death. But it won't be solved technologically. Why? Because, as Genesis tells us, it's a moral and spiritual rebellion against God that caused it. That fall, so to speak, into sin, rebelling against the word of God, had physical consequences. But they're not going to be solved by advances in medicine because of their very nature. So Genesis can help us analyze what's going on in the thinking of many people on this topic at the moment.
One last question. Since you have written a book addressing a lot of the themes we find in the book of Genesis, what do you make of the contrast between the Tower of Babel, which men attempt to build in Genesis 11, and the ladder which God himself reveals to Jacob in Genesis 28, in which, of course, Jesus alludes to in his conversation with Nathanael in John chapter 1.
The almost amusing thing about the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11 is they were using human technology and ability, mm-hmm. and they wanted to build a tower that reached to heaven, as they put it. But it didn't quite reach because the text puts it rather beautifully and says God came down to look at it, so it hadn't got that far.
Yeah.
And yes, it is an expression. Someone once wrote that skyscrapers, and you probably noticed that every country in the world vies to have the tallest building.
Yep.
And someone once wrote, perhaps cynically, that behind every skyscraper, there is an even bigger ego. They are symbols of humans reaching for godlike characteristics. And Jacob, you see, later on, you're mentioning in Genesis, the idea that there's an access, that there is a ladder. And the very interesting thing is that, as I understand the text, God is at the bottom of the ladder. He's at the bottom. He's come down to be with Jacob. And Jacob's reaction shows that. Surely God is in this place.
Yeah.
That was the new thing about it. It wasn't surely God is in heaven. He knew that. It was God actually coming down. He came down to be with Jacob. So he came a lot further down, so to speak, than he had at the Tower of Babel.
And Jacob wasn't even looking for him. He wasn't building anything. He was, in fact, leaving the promised land because his brother wanted to kill him.
He was running away. Yes, that's exactly right. And then in John chapter 1, as you say, talking to Nathanael, Jesus pointed out that one day Jacob's vision was going to be fulfilled in a big way, where Jesus himself would be revealed as the one who is at the center of the government of the universe. He is then the true Homo Deus. And John's gospel particularly is full of that claim that he is the Son of God.
Right.
And that's where Christianity centers on. So all of this hype about humans becoming gods through artificial intelligence is utterly beside the point. It's not real, but what Christ promises is real. It isn't artificial.
Well, you've been hearing from John Lennox, author of 2084, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity. Dr. Lennox, thanks for being my guest once again on the White Horse Inn.
Thank you very much for interviewing me. It's been very interesting.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.